Captain Featherstone Delk, Reel 4. We were discussing your time aboard HMS Malcolm of the 8th Escort Group on Atlantic convoys. Now, during this time, as you mentioned, you sank a submarine, the U-651. Could you tell us, in as much detail as you remember now, what exactly happened with the U-651?
Well, we got an ASDIC contact and we attacked a number of times. We and another destroyer, little destroyer called HMS Scimitar, S-C-I-M-I-T-E-R. And eventually we lost contact with her. And I remember we had the doctor, this was in daylight, I remember we had the doctor on the bridge. And he suddenly sighted a puff of smoke on the horizon. And we put on our binoculars, and there, by God, was a surface submarine. And this smoke was from her starting up her diesels. And so we crammed on all speed and went tearing along at about 31 knots, which is about all the Malcolm would do. And eventually, we saw this submarine sink. And there was a most enormous thing like a lilo, a great air cushion, I suppose about 30 foot by 30 foot. And on it were all these Germans, the crew, who had abandoned ship. They couldn't dive, was the answer. They had surfaced, and there was some defect which prevented them from diving. Anyway, we picked them all up, the entire crew, captain downwards. There were no casualties. And we had them on board until we got back to Londonderry, where we disembarked them.
Do you know the date of the sinking of the U-651?
Yes. It was the 29th of June, 1941. So the water wasn't too cold for them.
Any other incidents during... I mean, were you on convoys all the time? You were on her from May 41 to
yes, on
December 41.
Convoys the whole time, yeah.
And any other incidents?
We used to go into Iceland to fuel. Of course, having turned over to the Canadian group, we then used to go into Iceland to fuel and then sweep back to England.
Would you get
or else we might pick up another eastbound convoy and bring that back.
Would you get ashore at Iceland, at Reykjavik? Or?
No, we used to go to Valfjord, which is a large fjord to the west of Reykjavik.
What would you say about convoy discipline of the merchantmen?
Very variable, very variable. Of course, some were fast convoys and some were slow. The slow convoys usually tended to straggle rather more than the fast ones because they hadn't got enough puff to catch up, you know. I think, considering the circumstances and the sort of weather one finds in the North Atlantic, that they did astonishingly well, because they weren't used to it. It was quite foreign to them to have to keep stationed on somebody else and submit yourself to convoy discipline, so to speak. But we used to go in a sort of quiet period. Howard Johnson would take the ship through the lines of the convoy with a loud hailer going, sort of shouting encouragement to those who were lagging behind a bit or were making too much smoke, or generally sort of trying to ease their morale a bit, because it must have been pretty dreary for them.
What was the weather like? I mean, what was it like being at sea in bad weather? People, landlubbers like us, don't really understand it. What was it like in a bad
weather? Well, you tended to be wet all the time, because these were open bridges, you see. We hadn't got any enclosed bridge. And so if you were going into a head sea, there was spray coming right up over the bridge. And although you were dressed up in oilskins, sou'westers and everything else, and sea boots, you came off watch absolutely sodden. And bloody tired, so really, so coping with the rolling and pitching of the ship. You've got to hang on to something, otherwise you fall over. You were fairly physically tired by the time you came off watch, as well as being wet.
Was she a dry ship below decks?
Oh, okay, okay, below decks, yes, provided people shut the doors properly. And we're retired if they didn't. But no, one usually went below to a dry bunk, with luck. But then you've got to get up 4 hours later, have to put on your wet clothes, and go up to the bridge again.
Were the waves, were you really thrown about in the bad weather?
Oh, God, yes, it was a fire that size. Absolutely thrown about. I mean, you rolled immensely. There were no stabilizers or anything like that. You just rolled like anything, and pitched, and showers of spray over the bridge. And going along the deck, you had to hold on to something the entire time, otherwise you'd be washed overboard. In fact, one of the sub-lieutenants, one of my colleagues, he was washed overboard by one wave and back on board by the next wave. Lucky boy. Works the Lord again.
Now, what about... did you have any casualties in the sense of did you lose many merchant ships in the convoys?
No, touch wood, we didn't. I can only remember one, I think. And we picked up... I remember the captain of this merchant ship. He survived. And he was the most enormously fat man. He must have weighed, over 20 stone, I should think. And he hadn't got the strength, being rather a fat chap, to clamber up the what we used to call the scrambling nets, which were sort of great big rope nets you put over. And he hadn't got the strength to do it. And we had one hell of a job to get this chap up out of the water. Because he was absolutely sodden and very fat. And I should think he was a chap of about 60 or so.
Had the merchantman been torpedoed?
They've been torpedoed, yeah. Mm.
And how did you manage? I mean, did you always rescue them, or were you...
Well, in the early days, the ships of the escort had to do the rescuing. Later on, the Admiralty introduced things called rescue ships, which were small merchant ships carrying medical staff and extra means of getting people out of the water. And if you had a casualty, you took the convoy on with the escorts, and the rescue ship, very people they were, they stayed behind, picked up the survivors that they could, and they, as I say, had medical people on board, and then they caught up with the convoy as soon as they possibly could. But in the early days, I'm talking about sort of 1941, they hadn't introduced the rescue ships, and so the escorts had to do all the picking up. And our doctor, of course, was there to assist, but it wasn't an easy business.
I mean, how many of the crew would you get? It had been torpedoed, I presume, this merchantman.
Sure, yes.
How many would you rescue of the crew?
Well, all who survived. I mean, some would have been probably killed in the explosion, especially if it was in the engine room, the torpedo. And so perhaps you only had, two-thirds of the crew surviving. Some would have drowned, some would have been unable to swim, you picked up those who were lucky.
Now, anything else about the actual convoys? Any other incidents that stand out?
I don't think so, no, not in the Malcolm, no.
What about back in Londonderry? What was life like in port?
Life was very gay, in the old-fashioned sense. There was a thing called the Derry Games, which was a tremendous sort of dance, which all the naval officers used to go to. There was one...
What were the dances like? Can you give us an idea?
It was old-fashioned. I mean, there was ballroom dancing in those days. Jive hadn't been invented. And there were plenty of girls. You see, there were lots of wrens at Londonderry. And they were tremendous fun. There was, I think, about a couple of hotels in Londonderry, where you would get a good dinner, that sort of thing. And occasionally you would go over to the Irish Free State, as it was in those days, Ulster. No, not Ulster.
Era.
Era, yes. Nobody, the Irish police and so forth didn't ban an eyelid. And you'd hire a car and go over there, where, of course, you could buy all sorts of things you couldn't get in England, things like good butter and silk stockings and heaven knows what, which you'd bring back for your wives and whatnot. So that was rather fun. But no, we enjoyed ourselves to the full, as young men do when they get back from a fortnight's rather uncomfortable life at sea.
How often would you be out? I mean, how long would you be ashore for?
We have about a fortnight between trips.
So back, 2 weeks on, two,
2 weeks. And then off on another convoy. Occasionally, of course... Oh, no, it wasn't Malcolm. That was later on, no.
Anything else about the Malcolm? I just got that you were on aboard her for about 5 or 6 months, till December 41. Anything else?
That's right. Then, well, she went into refit in somewhere in South Wales. I forget where it was. Cardiff, I think. And I left her and joined the Hurricane, where to my amazement I found Captain Howard John, or the Commander Howard Johnson, transferred to Hurricane. I got on with him very much better in Hurricane. I was his sort of the captain's secretary. I dealt with all the paperwork and so on. And
what did that actually entail? Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, you had to log in all the correspondence. You had to take, I wouldn't say take dictation, but almost, take a form of dictation, I suppose, on him. They're not shorthand. Because after every trip, you had to write up a report of proceedings, an entire detailed account of everything that had gone on during the convoy of operation. And being the senior officer, he had to provide that. And I used to have to draft it, which entailed quite a lot of research and looking at the deck log to see what we'd done and things like that. Otherwise, I had to deal with all the incoming correspondence and the promotion and discipline of the sailors, all the sort of bumps that goes along with that. But I got quite used to it, and I wasn't too bad at it, and I could type reasonably well.
Now, you'd also be an officer of the watch, of course.
Oh, Lord, yes.
Did you have any other responsibility? Or were you navigating officer as well?
No, I wasn't. No. No, I was... I was a sort of gunnery officer. I sent in the director, again, I think, as the rate officer. But we never had to fire our guns, as far as I remember, which was lucky.
Now, you were with the B1 escort group.
B1 escort group, yes.
And where were you based?
Still at Londonderry. Yes.
And what exactly was the Hurricane doing?
The Hurricane was one of the Brazilian H's. Just before the war, the Brazilians ordered, I think, 4 or 5 destroyers from British shipyards. And as soon as the war broke out, the Brits said, no, you can't have them. We're going to have them instead. And so they took them on, and Hurricane was one of the 5. And they were known as the Brazilian H's. And they looked very much like the conventional destroyer which we were operating, the A to I class, as you might say, with 2 funnels, 4 single 4.7-inch guns, and 8 torpedo tubes. So they were quite conventional ships, except they had a slightly different fire control system to that which we'd been accustomed to. Well, that was all right.
And what were the B1 escort group up to? What was your role?
Well, we were doing exactly the same in Malcolm. It was escorting convoys, except in the case of a Hurricane, we used occasionally to be able to go and take convoys down to Gibraltar. That was tremendous.
Tell me about Gibraltar.
We used to see the sea see the sun for a change, and we managed to do one convoy and sink a submarine. U-506.
Now, tell me about that, then.
Well, I say sinker. We didn't sinker. They were sunk by the Air Force, and we picked up the survivors.
Can you tell us a story? What happened?
Well, I wasn't there when she was sunk. We were radioed by the aircraft and saying she'd sunk this thing. It was an American aircraft, I think. And she said she sunk this thing. And so we went along and found them swimming around in the water. Some of them, not all of them. Some just died. And so we picked them up and took him to Gibraltar. And I remember we kept them down below as we entered the harbour, and on the jetty at Gibraltar there was a military guard with fixed bayonets and everything else looking very fierce. And as the first of these sailors came up from below, I turned to him and I said, "Where do you think you are?" And he looked around like this. He said, "Liverpool? There was the Rock of Gibraltar." I don't know if you've ever been to Gibraltar, but you can't miss the Rock of Gibraltar. And he thought it was Liverpool. It was almost unbelievable. Anyway, we put him ashore in the care of the army. That was the last we saw of them. But they were all quite well behaved and so forth. They weren't arrogant and that sort of thing. There it was. No, I, one of them particularly spoke quite a good English, and I remember sitting on the after end of the ship, and and discussing life with him. And it was just at that time, I remember, that we heard that Hitler had invaded Russia. And we were absolutely overjoyed. We reckoned this is going to be the end of the Germans. And indeed it was. But I remember sitting alongside him when the news came through. And he said, oh, we'll be in Moscow in a fortnight or something. Well, there you went, of course.
And anything else about your time on the hurricane? You were on it quite a long time.
Indeed, yes. I put up my second stripe.
What did that entail?
Well, going to the tailor and having another.
Did you have to take another more exams?
No. I did all my exams. No, she was a very happy ship. We had a very nice lot of officers on board.
What made it so happy?
Well, there were no rough ones. We had a most charming Australian sub-lieutenant and a New Zealander. There was never any sort of upsets or quarrels or tempers lost or anything like that. It was a very civilized wardroom indeed. And a very happy ship.
How did you get on with the crew? I mean, we haven't asked about this before, but how generally did you get on with the men, the petty officers and leading seamen and the men?
Absolutely fine, yeah. And of course, most of them were, well, as you may say, a large proportion of them were hostilities only, and had had jobs before in civil life. Towards the end of the time, I had a new captain, a chap called Bill Baildon, who was an absolutely charming man. Again, an anti-submarine specialist.
Bill Baildon.
Baildon, B-A-Y-L-D-O-N, Baildon, yeah. He died, about 4 years ago at the age of 101. He had a good innings.
What was he like then? Can you just give us an idea what he was like as a captain?
It's difficult to say, except he was a total jet in every way. Thought for you, when he'd gone to the end of the earth for him. He was very, very considerate, which is what does help a lot if you're in a small ship. You know. He expected high standards, but he didn't bore you out or anything like that, and didn't sort of criticize you in front of others. He was a five-star.
Did he know his stuff?
Oh, he knew his stuff, absolutely, yeah. And did it without fuss or anything else. I had a lot of time with him. He was a charming chap.
Were you aware of any developments in the sort of North Atlantic anti-submarine war? You know.
We were fitted in Hurricane with what used to be called HFDAF, high frequency direction finding, which was capable of intercepting the wireless transmissions from U-boats. In fact, we had a special officer on board whose sole job it was to deal with this high-frequency direction finding. And if you got what was called a ground wave signal, that meant that the submarine was extremely close, I mean, perhaps within 30 miles of you. A sky wave must have been, or it might have been 200 miles away from them. But it was a tremendous asset, because if you got one of these ground wave signals, it was worth turning around onto the bearing of the signal and screeching down into 30 knots. And as likely as not, you'd see this chap still on the surface, if you were lucky. And, of course, he'd die without without wasting time. But you might pick him up. And it was a tremendous advantage. That, and we had radar, too. Although not a very good radar for surface use. It was really an air warning radar. But at least it was something, and it would sometimes pick up small things like a conning tower or a submarine, especially if you had a really good operator. So those were the advantages we had.
What about, were you very aware of the use of depth charges? I mean, did you have done that at Verne?
We had depth charges, and later on, we had a thing called a hedgehog.
Tell us about the depth charges first. How did you use the depth charge? You did them at Vernon, didn't you?
You learned how it worked. You rolled them over the stern, or fired them out of mortars called depth charge throwers, which threw out to the side, and that's if you had both the mortars and the ones going over the stern, that constituted a pattern of depth charges, which could be either, well, the maximum he could do was 14. That was a big bang. And then against the German homing torpedoes, we had a thing called the Foxer, or the Unifoxer it was.
What's that?
It was a thing you tear a stern. It was called a pipe noisemaker, PNM, and it had a whole lot of metal pipes, and they rattled together and made the most tremendous racket in the hope that it would cause the homing torpedo to home on the Foxer and not on the ship's propellers, which is what it was intended. And a number of ships were saved when the torpedo was bamboozled by the Foxer.
Would these be acoustic torpedoes?
German acoustic torpedoes, which were very lethal.
Any other new developments? You mentioned the Hedgehog.
We had the Hedgehog.
Did that come in then, or was that later?
No, we had it in Hurricane.
Did you explain what that was?
That was mounted in the position of the forward gun, a gun. And it was in the head-throwing mortar. And it fired 24 projectiles, each containing 30 pounds of explosive. And it fired them about 300 yards ahead of the ship. And if one of those, when they came down to the water, if one of those hit the submarine and detonated, then the whole pattern countermined and went off together. So that was a good big bang. But the great advantage of the Hedgehog was that you could maintain contact with the sonar right up to the moment of firing. Whereas with the depth charges, you lost contact because you had to go over the submarine in order to drop the depth charges. So that was a considerable advance. You could creep out quite slowly and fire this thing ahead of you. And it wouldn't damage the ship, but we hopefully would damage the submarine.
Anything else new? Were you very familiar with the use of ASDIC? I mean, yourself? I mean, did you understand it?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. Hmm. No, nothing sort of very magical about it. I think it, if you got an echo off something, well, that was fine. Ping, ping. Or ping pong, whatever the case may be.
Would you be able to interpret yourself, or would you need the trained operator?
Oh, you could interpret yourself. Oh, sure. Except you wouldn't know whether it was moving left or right. But you could hear the pings through a loudspeaker on the bridge. And I mean, some things just obviously aren't a submarine. But a submarine gives a good sort of metallic, a really solid echo. Bing! And you say, by God, that sounds good. And so you smell around a good deal more, and if necessary, give it a, go over the Hedgehog or a depth charge to shake it up, see what's there. Or you can get a ping off a shoal of fish. And porpoises and whales. But you can hear porpoises and you can hear whales. They sing underwater.
Any other developments in anti-submarine warfare?
No, not at that time, no.
So anything else about your time on the Hurricane? Any other incidents?
No.
You're on lots of convoys, obviously.
All convoys, yes, yeah. No, a very happy ship, and I was sorry to leave her, but it was. And she was eventually sunk on Christmas Eve, 1943, I think, yes, by a gnat, by one of these acoustic torpedoes.
And that about
I left her by then.
You left her in September?
In September, yeah. But then I went over to the States.
Now, tell me about that. How did you come to go to the States?
Well, the Americans were building under Lend-Lease a number of things which they called DEs, destroyer escorts, and we called captain-class frigates. And they were building them in a number of shipyards in the USA, in particular one just south of Boston, at Hingham, H-I-N-G-H-A-M. And there they were building these things, and I was sent over to stand by one of them, HMS Rio.
So you went to Boston?
So I sailed across the Atlantic in the Andes, that's right, enormous great ship, and we arrived in New York.
Anything about the crossing?
No, well, luckily it was uneventful, unescorted we were. And I had about a week in New York, being royally entertained by New Yorkers, And then I went down to Boston.
Now, we're quite interested in that. What did they put on for you? Because there's quite a lot in the Captain Class book about the sort of entertainment organised for officers and sailors. What do you remember?
Being invited out to dinner and drinks and theatres and you name it. I mean, all the fun in New York, which is quite a city. And then I went down to Boston and down to the shipyard. And I obtained digs in a little village, or it was then a little village, called Hingham. It was a family called Harrington. They were most charming. And they gave me a bed and breakfast and an evening meal. And I caught a bus from Hingham down to the shipyard every day.
And you knew your ship was HMS Rio?
I did indeed. I saw her launched. And then we commissioned her about 10 days later, I think. It was absolutely staggering, the speed at which they built and commissioned these ships. I mean, they launched about one a week and they commissioned about one a week. It was quite astonishing. All prefabricated and welded together, largely by women welders. Amazing.
What were your first impressions of the ship? Because they were not a conventional destroyer or anything.
No, they weren't. I've never seen anything quite like them. I mean, they were rather smaller than a destroyer. Totally welded, no portholes or scuttles, as we would call them in the Navy.
What did you think of the all welding? You were used to riveted ships.
I don't think we had thought very much about it, except it was astonishing that you could weld the ship completely. But everything was metal on board, because the Americans, like us, were afraid of fire. And so your desk was metal, the wardroom dining table was metal, all the chairs were metal. The curtain into my cabin was made of fiberglass. It would melt, but it wouldn't catch fire. Of course, for a little ship of that size, you wouldn't expect to find a laundry for the sailors. But the Americans have laundries in their ships, and so we had a laundry. And it was cafeteria messing, you know, all central cooking and everything else. And then the sailors went along with a tray, the same as you do in a cafeteria in England. But the sailors, of course, thought that most extraordinary. Didn't like it at all at first, but eventually they got used to it, and reckoned it was good ho. But at first, the sailors thought an awful lot of things were simply not up their street. I mean, not acceptable.
Well, they were all bunks as well. I don't know whether the officers
They were bunks. They were bunks, indeed. I had a fairly normal bunk, metal, but with a mattress. But the sailors didn't like bunks. Again, they got used to it, as one has to.
Now, there were these added facilities. There were water coolers and this laundry. What did you think of that sort of facility?
Well, maybe you could get a clean shirt in about an hour. You know, it was quite a thing. And the sailors, who used to be doing their derby in a bucket, you know, they could send it to the laundry. And we had it was run by a couple of the sailors who'd gone on a course in how to run the laundry, and they did absolute wonders. In the old days, you used to have a few Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese who did your laundry on board the ship.
Now, what did you think of the engines? Was it a diesel electric?
Mine was a turbo-electric.
What did you think of that system?
Well, I didn't honestly have very much to do with it. I was the first lieutenant, but we had an engineer officer, of course, who ran the engines. But
it's very different, though, isn't it?
Well, all you wonder is that the propellers go around the right way. But it took a little bit of getting used to it from the point of view of the engine room department. But they managed it. We never had any panics that, you know, we couldn't go astern or something, or couldn't get the thing out of gear or whatever.